You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, we look at media ownership in Russia.
This is CNN.
And CNN's decision to stop broadcasting in the country due to its new media laws. John Everard and George Brock will tell us more about that, and we'll take a closer look at the APEC summit in Beijing to explore who's getting friendly with whom. Then we look at a modern twist on the Sikh faith.
So we noticed about a year and a half ago there were a lot of people in London with beards. Everyone had a beard, and we thought, okay, let's do a project based around our people, the Sikh people, the Singhs, who have beards and turbans.
That's as a gallery in London showcases the beards and turbans of a new generation of men. And we'll find out what is in the Brazilian weeklies for Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Fernando, what do you have in store for us?
Well, this week, the weeklies are discussing President Dilma's isolation after being narrowly re-elected last month, plus a potential dangerous virus in Brazil that some are saying is worse than Ebola.
All that, plus a sneak peek at the must-see lineup at the Jar 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 Music Festival. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots in the next hour on Midori House, but before any of that, Jonathan Wheatley.
The captain of the South Korean ferry, which sank in April, killing more than 300 people, has been jailed for 36 years for gross negligence. Prosecutors had been seeking the death penalty for 68-year-old Lee Jong-suk, but he was found not guilty of murder by negligence. The other two senior officers were given 20 and 15 years. The verdict of negligence rather than homicide has angered many victims' relatives as being far too lenient. Eight women have died after undergoing sterilization surgery at a government-run camp in the central Indian state of Chhattisgarh. 10 more women who also had the procedure are in a serious condition. Such camps are held regularly to control India's booming population. The 83 women received incentive payments of 1,400 rupees, that's $23, to have the surgery. Well, the leader of the Communist Party of India, Brinda Karat, said all women involved in the incident should receive compensation.
Demand an end to the target-based approach, and we demand full compensation to the women who have been victimized by this wrong policy approach.
Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan announced today that he would seek a second term in a February election and vowed to defeat a five-year-old northern Islamist insurgency that has blighted his leadership of Africa's biggest economy. He is seen as a strong incumbent despite his government's inability so far to end the insurgency waged by Islamist group Boko Haram, mostly in the Muslim north. Fishing countries gathered in Italy today for a week-long meeting due to set new fishing quotas for Atlantic bluefin tuna, but the World Wildlife Fund's communications manager, Gemma Parks, is warning that too quick an increase in fishing quotas could put the species right back on the emergency list.
We know that when you have the BCD document and you have the fish, they don't match. And that's a huge problem because it allows for some illegal fish to enter the markets. So what we would like to tell the contracting parties here and the delegates is if you want to increase, fair enough, but it has to be something moderate, it has to be gradual, and first of all, we need to have this traceability system in place and fully working.
The author Dan Brown has condemned book burning during a speech in New Delhi. Brown, who wrote the record-breaking bestseller The Da Vinci Code, was giving the annual Penguin Lecture in the Indian capital.
I think people who burn books do so because they don't have an intelligent response. I think a far more productive way to disagree with something, whether it's my book or really any book, is to come up with an alternative and either write your own book or state it publicly.
And finally, a high school in Colorado, one of the first two U.S. states to legalize recreational marijuana use, was put on lockdown after a student's weed pipe filled a classroom with pot smoke. The smoke from the device was released into a classroom at Adams City High School in Commerce City, a northeastern suburb of the maybe appropriately named Mile High City of Denver. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is at 18.06. That means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is regular John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, among other places, and George Brock, media professor. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start with a media story, in fact, because one of the largest international television outfits is pulling out of Russia. CNN says it will stop broadcasting on Russian televisions by the end of the year, citing changes in media ownership laws. CNN began operating in Russia in 1993, just a few years after the channel launched in the United States, and of course just a few years after the Berlin Wall fell. Then last month, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a law lowering the maximum share of Russian mass media companies that foreign organisations could hold, from 50% to just 20%. This called the news organisation's future into some doubt, and today we've seen potentially the results of that. George, is it a bad moment for media to see CNN pulling out of Russia?
Yeah, I think it's a really bad and a really sad moment, but I don't blame them for anticipating the inevitable. The reduction to 20% for foreign shares in media operations is not really designed to make things easy. It's designed to make things impossible. And I think CNN are just, I don't know whether CNN have explored whether it is possible to reorganize the way they do. They have quite a complex set of redistribution arrangements in Russia, as they do in most places. I don't know whether they've tried to reorganize them and failed, or just decided that they wouldn't manage it anyway. And they've just said, okay, let's get out for now. Let's then see what happens.
Although, interestingly, George, I was just looking at TASS before I came on, and they're saying it's a load of nonsense. You know, they've pulled out because they want to pull out. There was no reason to leave at this time. Do you think that maybe just there could be a sense that they just don't want to fight this? They just feel, you know, it's not a market worth combating at this time.
Oh, I think CNN think it's a market worth being in. I think they just don't think the government want them there. I think it's as simple as that. I think what TASS is saying is complete nonsense. I think if the law hadn't changed, they'd be carrying on. And don't forget, this law is going to do a whole load of other damage too. You know, there is a very, very good business-oriented newspaper in Russia called Vedomosti, one of the ones on which businessmen, Russian and international businessmen rely. It's a three-way deal with News Corporation and the FT, Wall Street Journal, the FT, and a Russian owner. That falls too. That goes. We're reading about the CNN story on Vedomosti's site. Quite soon, that site may not be there.
John, you've sat in several countries who do their utmost to make sure that you only hear one message, and that message is centrally controlled with a high degree of, you know, authoritarian rule. Russia isn't quite there at those stages of, say, a North Korea or a Belarus yet. But how effective is it shutting down these TV stations and making it difficult for these people to operate? If you limit the number of cable channels, does that limit how people think about the world? Or actually, in this day and age, when we can log onto our computers and we can see what's happening beyond our borders, is it actually very difficult for a country like Russia to shut down on that?
It doesn't shut Russia off completely, of course not. As you rightly point out, you can still log onto your computer and watch internet channels. It does, however, make it a great deal more difficult. And I think, you know, a lot of people find it more intuitive, shall we say, to simply flick a television on than to log onto a computer. I agree entirely with George. I think this is a very sad day. I think this is a very retrograde step. CNN have grabbed the headlines partly because they're CNN and partly because they have acted preemptively. But this is going to close down pretty much all of the Western news effort in Russia. It is part of Putin's agenda, I think, to prevent people getting any kind of messages apart from the ones that he wants them to hear. I wonder whether he's factored in the anger that this will cause in the business community, indeed in the wider Russian middle classes, who rely on these media for their information. It's not going to win Putin a lot of friends in wide sectors of the Russian population.
George, we say that, but whatever Mr. Putin seems to do, he seems to maintain a kind of popularity rating at home, which is kind of off the charts. Do you think that beyond a kind of small middle class, that will matter? I can see that John wants to jump back in on this question as well. But
well, in that case, I'll be brief. I think that what they're not factoring in is, okay, sure, an isolationist, strong Russia, be aggressive to foreigners, may play quite well in the short term. But Russia does depend. It is a very, very big economy. It depends on partnerships, trade, being able to sell its oil and its gas and all that kind of stuff. Isolation past a certain point, in the end, bears down on Russians and their standard of living. It takes a time to happen, but it will if he keeps going.
John, you had a shaking head there. Are you going to suggest that Mr. Putin's popularity could fade?
Oh, I think it is fading. I think the numbers are fairly clear that when the Ukraine crisis broke, it went into orbit, but it's been crawling back ever since. And remember, this is happening in the week where the Russian credit rating has been downgraded yet again, and there's real pressure on the ruble. There's been a further rise in Russian interest rates, trying to shore the currency up. The Russian economy is in deep trouble, and this is going to tell in the way that Russians view Putin, I'm sure.
And what was your view, both of you, on the words this week of Mikhail Gorbachev, who said, you know, that we were facing potentially a new Cold War? Actually, John, stay with you on this. You know, again, you've sat behind the former Iron Curtain, and you've seen how it feels to watch the world from that angle. Do you feel that's a fair comment?
I think he's right to point to the risk. I don't think we're there yet. And perhaps I'm in a minority, but I don't think that we can yet exclude a reasonably peaceful settlement over Ukraine. We'll just have to see how things go. If there is a further flare-up of Ukraine, and if Putin signs many more such drafts into law, then yes, we're back to close to where we were in the early 1980s.
And George, as a popular band once ended, back to the USSR?
Not quite, but we're not talking about the vast armed camps and alliances that we had in the Cold War, but you only have to remember a few months back in the Ukraine crisis how nervous people in the Baltic republics got. Mm. They've got large Russian populations. That's what the Ukraine had too. Okay, they're not in danger at the moment, but I think Gorbachev has put his finger on something, even if it isn't exactly like it was in the 70s and 80s.
Well, Mr. Putin is going to be making another return later on in the show, because we'll be talking about APEC later on. But first, attempted murder, waging war on the state, criminal intimidation, fraud. These are not the qualifications you'd look for in a cabinet minister. However, in India, 7 of 21 new ministers face prosecution for crimes of this nature. Prime Minister Narendra Modi appointed the cabinet on Sunday, jarring with his pledge to clean up politics. Finance Minister Arun Jaitley said any suggestions that there were criminals in the cabinet were completely baseless, going on to tell reporters, there are cases arising out of criminal accusations, not cases out of a crime. That's a nice kind of way of twisting the words. John, we'll jump back with you. You're shaking your head. This is a strange period for India. It is meant to be a period of cleaning up politics, not business as usual, trying to present a more contemporary face for the country. It's not a great first step, is it?
Well, I wonder. I mean, clearly, having a third of your cabinet charged with corruption of various kinds doesn't encourage foreigners to believe in your country. On the other hand, under previous administrations, I very much doubt if the corruption was any less. It's just the cabinet ministers got away with it. Nobody actually got round to charging them. So that actually putting the charges on the table is a first step forward. It may be a difficult thing to do, and it doesn't look pretty, but it's progress.
George is not so sure about your version of progress, but what's your feeling?
Well, I hope John is right. It's an ingenious theory. I like it. But on the other hand, imagine yourself as Mr. Modi. What do you do? You don't have as much in a democracy, particularly a vast democracy, very decentralized and federalized. How many options do you have? There are some people you have to have in your cabinet. You don't, you know, even if you won an election, there are debts you have to pay off, there are regions and so on you have to pay notice to. And such a high proportion of these people are at least accused of crimes. What I would rather hear from Modi is, you know, in the end, we're going to speed up the justice system, we're going to make it less complicated, we're going to determine innocence or guilt quicker, we're going to do something about this in the future. I don't, you know, in the short run, maybe there's nothing he can do about it, but I'd like to know what he thinks about the future.
It's funny the filter we look at world events through, John, because, you know, actually we're just talking about, you know, Russia there. I presume that most people in Russia have a higher standard of living than they do in India. I wonder if, you know, the state of, you know, of crime, of corruption in politics is really that different. Yeah, India, we always kind of give it kind of a good press and we kind of are very welcoming to its leaders, but they're not doing well by their people. Why is it, do you think, we actually give the Indian administrations actually quite a good clean run of, you know, getting away with it?
Well, I think we regard corruption in India, or corruption in any country, essentially as a problem for that country to solve. It's not an international issue. And, you know, as I say, at least in India, they're charging the people. How many Russian politicians have been charged with corruption recently? I think the difference in treatment...
Well, they have if they upset Mr. Putin.
But... Well, yes, fair point. Very fair point. But I think the big difference in treatment arises not from the fact that, you know, politicians may or may not be corrupt in the two countries, as from the way that the two countries are behaving on the international stage. I mean, India has not sent tanks into a neighbouring country recently.
True. Okay, now we're going to take a slight pause and then we're going to return to what looked like a Star Trek convention, but which is in fact the APEC meeting that is happening in China. But you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, John Everard, and of course, George Brock.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour programme packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the US and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS. Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. The time in London... It's 8:19. The APEC summit, well, it's finally over. Well, it's quite short, actually. 21 countries met in Beijing to much fanfare. All eyes were on key political figures and how they interacted with each other. Whether it was China's President Xi Jinping and Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, or US President Barack Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin, it left watchers reading body language and studying news conferences to analyse exactly what might be going on behind the scenes. I must say, this is one of the oddest conferences ever for watching who touched who and who helped who and who grabbed each other's elbow. So first of all, we had, you know, this awful kind of attempt at a handshake between the Chinese president and the Japanese prime minister. Then we had quite a gentle touch on the arm from Mr. Putin on Barack Obama. And then we had the move which upset Chinese censors, which was the Russian president putting his arms and shawls around the wife of the Chinese president to protect her from the chill. Apparently a job that should only be done by the president. And that image was wiped by censors very quickly. Daft in a way, but does this actually imply that we still don't really know what's going on in the political world, that we're left looking for these scraps of who likes who and who will get on with who?
I think we don't know the whole story, you're right, but I think what went on at the summit has told us a great deal. Firstly, China is busy signalling a change of course. This is the important thing to come out. I'll talk about that in a second. I just want to make the point that the key thing about this summit is that what actually went on the agenda, what APEC decided, nobody knows and nobody cares. It was all about the meetings in the sidelines, all about the subgroupings, and as you say, the handshakes and the touch on the shoulder. But China changing the way it does things. We've seen a reasonable meeting between Xi Jinping and President Obama and an apparent attempt to patch things up there. The handshake between Xi Jinping and Shinzo Abe, awkward, as you rightly say. Who cares? It was a handshake. And it was a handshake following the famous four-point communique that came out, was it 3 days ago? Which seems to be an important first step towards calming the temperature over the disputed islands. China is busy signalling to anybody who wants to watch that it is not looking for a fight anymore, perhaps because it's realised that the cost of its actions was just getting too great, but it is looking for a peaceful diplomatic climb down over the islands. One you haven't mentioned, the big handshake between President Xi Jinping and President Park Geun-hye of South Korea, where, astonishingly, they put out a communique saying they're going to work together to end North Korea's nuclear program. Can you imagine how that's gone down in Pyongyang, you know, China's only ally? I think, you know, when the dust settles on this summit, as I say, what happened at the summit itself won't matter. But the signals that China has sent and the way that China's foreign policy is being remodelled will come to be seen as really important.
George, you wanted to come in here. Are these stupid stories or are they significant, us reading the body language of these people?
No, I think in sum you're seeing China saying, look, there is a benign version to our new wealth and power. Here it is. I mean, the handshake with Prime Minister Abe of Japan was, you know, one of the most kind of awful, gauche, dreadful spectacles you can imagine. But actually, as John exactly rightly says, it was a very, very good signal indeed. And I think you're seeing a relatively... This is China saying, if you accord us the right kind of respect, we will behave a bit better. But you've got to give us the respect. Now, the one absolutely crucial thing you haven't mentioned, Andrew, or you mentioned it only obliquely, was the jackets they were wearing on day one. This is what everybody is obsessed by. I thought they were going to start talking about setting phasers to stun. The numbers of cover jokes we're going to have are just going to be amazing. That's the most extraordinary thing that people will remember about this summit, with all due respect to the important geopolitical diplomacy.
Although it turns out Mr. Obama looks quite nice in purple.
Well, it rather suits him, doesn't
it? Yeah, he got away with it. But the others, it's not a great... Now, the other thing is that we had, of course, Tony Abbott saying that he was going to, in his words, shirt front or T-Trek, rather Star Wars shirt front Putin. And then he got stuck standing right behind him, didn't he, in the pictures. He wasn't even able to kind of look him in the eye. But again, those animosities seem to have slightly faded once these people are actually in the same room.
Yes, I don't think Putin was looking for a spat actually at APEC. He's got enough problems on his hands right now, thank you.
And Mr. Abbott is a bit taller as well.
And he is a bit taller, that's right. And I'm sure that Putin read Mr. Abbott's remarks before the conference and sort of positioned himself accordingly.
Can I ask you a serious question, John, which is interesting about this conference is, you know, that it does seem that it comes down to common sense in the end about who talks to who and the significance of relationships. As you said, there's a common sense thing for Russia, which, and I mean for China, which is, yes, it's had this kind of trade deal with Russia that's been built up to great fanfare over recent months. But when it comes down to it, it's going to make its cash by dealing with the rest of Asia and through there to the US. And is that at the end of the day, we know that China ticks along on this kind of communist version of capitalism, that it needs to be making money for its middle classes and growing its middle class. Is that in the end what governed a lot of what we saw over the last two or three days?
Yes, absolutely. The Chinese leadership are very worried about their country's economic situation. Growth is still stellar by European or North American standards, but by Chinese standards, it's slowing quite rapidly, and the job production out of this growth is slowing even faster, which creates a whole range of social problems. So they are not going to be doing anything that risks economic performance. And as you rightly say, where China makes its money is the United States and Western Europe, effectively. Russia, yes, I think they were probably quite happy to play along, do a bit of fanfare, some symbolism, this new partnership between China and Russia. But remember that when we talk about Russia supplying China with gas, nothing's going to happen until some pipelines get built. And that is really quite some way down the track. So that this was a lot more form than substance, I think.
George, how do you think that China came out of hosting this event? You know, they managed to reuse many of the Olympic symbols. It was held in the former swimming complex. They had the most dramatic red carpet, electronic red carpet we've ever seen, I think, with the cars arriving over this road that lit up as they drove along. Do you think that put China in good stead? Do you think that when people watch around the world, it did the soft power PR that it wanted, that it made people, you know, in their sitting rooms around the world think, this is the new heart of power, this is the new economic might?
Yeah, I think it had a lot of good images for soft power projection, but I think you've got to take into account at the same moment that the audience that President Xi really cares about is inside China. They've got to bring down to earth the Chinese economy and do these big projects like building pipelines that John was mentioning just now without unleashing, if they, from their own point of view, opposition, dissidents, further riots, and so on. And he is very clear, Xi. The one thing I think he's really honest about is he's got a sclerotic and rather corrupt system to clean up first. None of that is going to be easy. So seeing, you know, all the stuff that builds up the government's authority, that's good magic outside, but it's even better magic inside.
And John, you touched on a subject, North Korea, and we should just get your opinion on this. You are the expert on this topic. How do you think it went down in Pyongyang? We saw in the run-up, you know, a bit of flurry in Pyongyang, releasing American prisoners, trying to get into the storylines of the world's press. But then, as you say, this kind of maneuver by China, do you think that there is fear in Pyongyang, or is it a bit like when Albania was surrounded on all sides, that there's a kind of a bunkering down mentality?
I think that there will be an instinct to bunker down, but I think there's real fear. Having your only ally and your main economic partner tell your arch rival that they're going to work together to close down one of your key national projects isn't good news for any country. Remember also that this happens as a draft resolution is going to the UN General Assembly, which would have the effect of recommending that that North Korea senior leadership are referred to the ICC. Now, North Korea needs China to block that move. And I think after what happened today, Pyongyang is going to be a lot less sure that China will help it out in this tight corner than it might have been.
So the noises off are just as much important as actually happening there in the key arena. George, final thoughts for you on the conference. Who do you think were the winners and the losers?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously Xi of China. I think Obama did it quite well, quite apart from looking good in the jacket. At least the only thing that could happen would be mistakes or embarrassments or humiliations, and he seems to have entirely avoided them. So I think if you were an American diplomat worrying about this kind of thing, you'd think that was a pretty good score.
And he probably enjoyed looking in charge for a few days after kind of a rather bad run at home.
Yeah, it's not, the things are not great in Washington as it is. I think Putin was okay, but everybody knows that, you know, Putin's international dealings are a mess, and that is a result of domestic problems which he's not really sorting out for the reasons we were discussing earlier. So I think Xi got what he wanted.
Well, gentlemen, a pleasure to be joined by you both here on Midori House, but we're going to have to leave it there. That's, of course, John Everard and George Brock even, giving him an extra S there. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. And John, of course, is the former British ambassador to North Korea, and George Brock is a professor of journalism.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Well, we've got lots more to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with Monocle's Fernando Agosto-Bacheco to see what's filling up the front pages of the weekly magazines in Brazil. But before that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the World News headlines.
Thank you very much. The captain of the South Korean ferry, which sank in April, killing more than 300 people, has been jailed for 36 years for gross negligence. Prosecutors have been seeking the death penalty for 68-year-old Lee Jong-suk. Eight women have died after undergoing sterilization surgery at a government-run camp in the central Indian state of Chhattisgarh. Such camps are held regularly to control India's booming population. Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan announced today that he would seek a second term in a February election and vowed to defeat a five-year-old northern Islamist insurgency that has blighted his leadership of Africa's biggest economy. And fishing countries gathered in Italy today for a week-long meeting due to set new fishing quotas for Atlantic bluefin tuna. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
And welcome back to Midori House Live here on Monocle 24. The time in London, it's 18.32, which means it's 21.32 in Moscow. Now, we're going to check in with what's happening on the weekly magazines around the world. It's a new segment we've started, and today we're heading to Brazil to take a closer look what's on their newsstands. And joining me is our very own resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Where are we going to start today?
So, Andrew, we're going to start with Veja, actually, which is the best-selling news magazine. Well, to be honest, it's the best-selling magazine in the country. They sell 1.1 million copies every week. It's like a middle-class staple. So think about Saturday morning spreading butter on your bread and with a copy of Veja in your hands. That's how relevant it is. They have a lot of subscriptions as well.
And there's a picture of the poor president, Dilma Rousseff, looking... Well, not very happy.
And the headline says, A Solidão da Vitória, The Loneliness of Victory. First, I have to give a little bit of a background, because Veja is very much anti-Dilma. In fact, just 2 days before the election, they published a big story saying that actually Dilma knew about the corruption scandals at Petrobras, just because they had the kind of, like a criminal said that, you know, so it was kind of a bit dodgy. But, and they continue with those negative stories against the government, so they're saying that she doesn't know what to do with the economy, she's been pressured by the Workers' Party, she's being snobbed by her allies, and so she's isolating her palace. So they're very, very, very almost right-wing, may I say.
Now, I do want to follow up with the yellow pages, which then follow in this magazine. And you've pointed out something which is quite fascinating here. So every week they kind of do an interview with someone over a few pages. And can you tell us who the star turn is this week?
Well, it's very interesting, you know, because usually they have prime ministers, actors in Hollywood, but this time we have a dermatologist. And yes.
Only in Brazil.
Only in Brazil, because, you know, dermatologists are gods in Brazil. And her name is Ligia Cogos. I mean, of course, I know her. I think every Brazilian would know her. She's a bit of a, you know, we have Ivo Pitanguia, a plastic surgeon. She's kind of the Ivo Pitanguia of dermatology. And she's giving tips, you know, how Brazilians should take care of their skin. And it's funny, Andrew, because, you know, of course, we're in a very kind of heavy political mood in Brazil at the moment. But usually on Veja, on their covers, they do a lot of health and lifestyle. So, I mean, I would say in a month, you would have a cover of the latest diet and saying, oh, actually, one day, I remember, I'll never forget that, they said, tips for your plastic surgery. That's on a weekly magazine, the best-selling in the country. So that's how you see, so, the, you know, Brazilians want that. And I think the magazine tries to give this to
them. I think you gave us a false image at the start. I don't think that Brazilians are going to be sitting there buttering their toast. They're going to be sitting there kind of squeezing their guavas, aren't they?
Exactly. Or making their appointment with Ligia Cogos, you know?
Yeah, okay.
It might be a bit expensive. And also, Andrew, just one quick thing, you know, together with Veja...
Can you get me that diet, by the way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. After the show. So we have Veja São Paulo, which is a little supplement with a guide for São Paulo. So even people who doesn't read Veja that much, to be honest, it's not my favorite magazine, I have to be honest. But I buy Veja just for this guide of the city of São Paulo. So it's together. They call Vejinha or Little Veja, which is quite a good supplement, you know.
Very good. Now, the next title you have for us is Epoca.
Yeah, let's talk about Epoca, which is a fairly new weekly magazine. I mean,
do they have a dentist on page 2?
They don't.
Okay.
Unfortunately. But, you know, it's more centrist than Veja. They sell 400,000 copies, not as much as them.
It is amazing that just the numbers, you know, 1.1 million, 400,000, you know, Brazilians are reading.
And growing, actually. You know, I think the growth of weekly magazines grew 2.7% compared to last year. So it's good news. But Epoca is not going after Dilma because they're not so much against her. And the cover is saying that there's a new virus, which apparently is more dangerous than Ebola, which is the virus let me pronounce this correctly, chikungunya, which is the same one that transmits dengue, which actually is quite a common disease in Brazil. In fact, in the last 5 years or so, we had 800 deaths, and they're saying that the situation can be worse than Ebola, in fact.
That's nice. They cheer you up over your... you wouldn't go out if you'd spread your butter and your toast. We're there after reading a pocket. But this is a disease that's happening in Brazil?
Exactly. And but they're saying that because of mutations, apparently it can only get worse. So, yeah, not very cheery at all.
Okay, and they have gone a bit more serious. So their doctor is actually a real Brazilian doctor who's been discussing Ebola as well.
That's a very nice, actually, story. It's a diary by this Brazilian doctor who works for Medicine Sans Frontières. His name is Pedro Reis. And, you know, it's a very nice story from the Brazilian point of view. And then he said, you know, that he felt safe, actually, in Africa. You know, when he went to Brazil, it's not such a big difference. Because he was not only talking about Ebola, he was talking about the living standards and, you know, and violence in general.
And now, as we totter across the political spectrum, we're ending up over on the other side of the political spectrum with a leftist publication to end with.
And there's a very interesting story about this magazine, Carta Capital, because the editor-in-chief of this magazine, Mino Carta, in fact, he was the founder of Veja in the late 60s. But he disagreed completely.
He's got amazing skin.
Yeah, of course. well, absolutely.
No, and tell me about him.
And it's interesting because, you know, now he's very, very much of a leftist and he's very close to former President Lula and President Dilma. In fact, when Dilma won, she only gave an interview to Carta Capital. Of course, she ignored Veja. And this week, the cover is Progress, you know, which is we have in our flag order in progress, order in progress. So they have a bit of our flag and say the only thing Brazil should do now is to grow. So it basically is a positive story how Brazil reduced inequality. I mean, we still have to improve some things on the economy, but they're definitely not as critical of Dilma's government as Veja, for example.
But fascinating, in a country which is currently slightly to the left of centre, it only sells 70,000 copies.
Well, it's not surprising as well, Andrew, because the majority of people who consume those things, they're based in São Paulo. And if you look at São Paulo, Aécio Neves, the opposition candidate, he won with 64%. So, you know, I think Dilma is better in areas that might not buy a weekly magazine in a way. Maybe they got more of their information from television.
Well, Fernando, that was fascinating. Thank you very much indeed. That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who was running through the Brazilian weeklies. And that's a new segment we have here on Midori House. But you're listening to Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. The turban and beard are the most obvious symbols of the identity of a Sikh man. In the past, Sikhs were persecuted because of their headgear and untrimmed facial hair. But today, these have come to symbolise nonconformity and a certain style too. Monocle's Guy Lutz headed down to the Framers Gallery to learn more about Sikh identity through the portraits of the photographer duo Amit and Naroop.
Hi, my name's Naroop. I'm one half of Amit and Naroop.
I'm Amit, the other half of Amit and Naroop, and today we are at the Singh exhibition.
If you could tell me, Amit and Naroop, how did this, first of all, this collaboration between both of you start?
Well, we've actually been working together for 9 years now. So we're a photography duo, and we mainly do kind of advertising, portraiture, and music photography. But we were looking to do a personal project that reflected our heritage as Indian Sikhs and also kind of showed our upbringing as a young British guy. So this is a project that fuses both of those dynamics.
So we noticed about a year and a half ago, there were a lot of people in London with beards. Everyone had a beard. And we thought, OK, let's do a project based around our people, the Sikh people, the Singhs, who have beards and turbans. So we knew that we wanted to get a good range of people from across the board. So youngsters, older guys, different jobs, different backgrounds. So we literally went down to the local temple. We tried to explain what we were doing to a few people. And we said, look, we're looking for some volunteers. Who's up for having their photo taken? So initially it was a bit hard, but once people saw what we'd done with the pictures, they were more than happy to tell other people with other Singhs who wanted to get involved about the project, and it kind of went from there.
And if you could tell me a bit, what are the main characteristics, obviously, aesthetically, of the Singhs?
So the name Singh actually is the surname given to every British Sikh man. But we kind of define Singhs as Sikh men with beards and turbans. So the beard and the turban are really the kind of two most obvious symbols of the identity of a Sikh man. The turban is like a spiritual crown. It covers the kind of uncut hair of the Sikh man, and the beard itself again is majority of the time is uncut. Sometimes some men do trim it, but it's for identity to help them kind of stand out from the crowd.
And if you could tell me a bit, there's a lot of this fusion, as I could see here, there's a property developer and a songwriter. How do the two things get incorporated, being a Sikh and being a songwriter, a property developer?
Well, the good thing about today's age is there are Sikhs and Singhs in every walk of life now. And, you know, 30, 40 years ago in the UK, I can't say if that would have been the case. But today, it's been really interesting seeing that identity doesn't stop you doing what you want to do, regardless if you wear a turban or you have dreadlocks or you wear something else. It's just, it's opened our eyes. We always knew that there were a lot of Sikhs and Singhs in different industries. But when we're actually doing it, I mean, we've had a polo player, for example, you know, and so they're just everywhere, basically. They're doing great things. They're everywhere. And it's just the message we've got is don't let your identity stop you or hold you back in any way. You know, this is a clear example of how great it is and how much people have been loving these pictures is amazing for us.
And tell me a bit about the process of taking the pictures. How much was it posed? How much was it from the own person's character? Did they choose their positions? Did you kind of stage it?
Posing was actually done in a very deliberate way. So we wanted to try to reflect the individual's personality, but also we wanted to try to incorporate some unconventional poses. So not your typical kind of look in the camera, you know, trying to pout. It was trying to draw out something special about them. So some of the guys do look quite serious. Some look meditative, like they're in meditation. Some people are smiling, you know, so it's a different thing for each individual person. And it was a process because sometimes there was a slight language barrier because some of them only spoke Punjabi and we speak a decent amount, but we're not trying to tell someone how to pose in Punjabi, the English translation always doesn't quite work. So that was interesting for us. That was a big challenge, but it was fun. And it's just amazing that they really enjoyed the process. I think that was one of the main things. A lot of these guys had never had their photo taken professionally. So for them, it was an amazing experience. And we're just glad that, you know, they can get something out of it because now within the community, a lot of them are recognized from this project. So it's great.
Can you show me one or two of your favorite shots and maybe the story behind it?
This photograph here is of Jasdeep Singh. He's a project officer working for the National Army Museum. So once we had actually shot the original 35 photographs for the project, we opened up a competition on Facebook to find the 36th member of the Sing Project. And we asked people to send in photographs of themselves along with some text as to why they should be involved in the project. And this gentleman sent in a photograph of him in a genuine World War I soldiers, Sikh soldier's outfit. So this is what they would have worn when they were fighting for the British. And, you know, he had the rifle, he's had this amazing turban, this curled up moustache, and we thought we had to get him in the exhibition. It's definitely one of my favourite photographs.
So for me, the portrait of Kanwar Singh, you can see right now, is really, really special to me. He is a boxer, but he's also a teacher and an instructor, and he does a lot of charity work around the world. So he flies around to different countries, giving aid, helping people. But just seeing a man, you know, with a beard and a turban who's got a lot of tattoos on him was quite incredible for me, really, to see him. We weren't sure how it would be received. But, you know, a lot of people have liked this picture, and it was just great seeing him. And there's something about the look in his face when you look at this that he looks quite powerful, and I like that about that.
Very fierce. Yes. Yeah. And if you could tell me a bit about the social outreach of your project. You mentioned a bit it's really to show the identity and how identity shouldn't stand in the way of anything you do. Rather, it can be incorporated in anything you do. What kind of reception have you had from people? Was it a very positive? Do you think people understood that message well?
Totally. Well, I think it's important to realize when Sikh people first came to the country, a lot of the time their beard and turban restricted them from getting employment. So if my grandfather, for example, had to shave off his beard, cut his hair and remove his turban in order to get a job. And this was just working at the airport. So it wasn't like it was a high-end job. It was a basic job. But now, you know, identity, individualism is embraced. You know, this project is about showing that you can have, stay true to your identity, stay true to who you are, but still you can achieve anything you want. So the times of conforming to society has changed. Now it's about expression, and people embrace that, people like that. And that's why we've got such a variety of people, from boxers to creative directors to doctors to magicians, filmmakers. They're all in here. So it's great to show that no matter what your beliefs, no matter how you choose to portray your identity, you know, there's no limits to what you can do.
Well, that was Monocle's Gaia Lutz speaking with Amit Anurup. The exhibition closes on November the 15th. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. Today, we talked to Nina Finnerud, who is ready to go through the music line of the Ya 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 Festival here in London. Now, before we go through that lineup, I think you should tell us, Nina, what is this festival?
Well, Ya 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 is a club night we run monthly at the Lexington. We've been running that since 2009. Last year, we decided to make a festival out of it because the club nights has been very successful. We've been selling them out every month. So,
and it's all Nordic music.
All Nordic music.
And so, you've got kind of big arms. You're taking everyone all the way from Finland all the way down to Denmark.
Yeah. So everyone like Finland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway and Iceland, obviously.
And then you have a kind of sister establishment that trades under the name or uses the same name in Berlin as well.
Yeah, we just set up the same concept in Berlin. We had our first night last month, and there's actually one on Thursday as well.
Brilliant. Well, let's start hear some of the music. So these are all bands that are going to be at the festival?
Yes.
Okay.
They are, yeah.
So we'll start with Heiserkeit even, which is Darth Vader. Well, that's Heiserkeit, who hail from Oslo. And I must point out, actually, in the current issue, we have a nice survey for Oslo, so look out for that. Tell us about this band.
Well, it's a five-piece from Oslo. They met studying jazz at the Trondheim Jazz Conservatory and started the band High as a Kite.
And it says that they do a spectacular show. What does that involve?
It's fantastic. Like, they've grown so much and their live show is amazing. Involves a lot of lights, different lights, and Ingrid, who sings, is amazing.
Just tell me, as we run through this, how many of these performers choose to use English and how many of them are kind of singing in their kind of own native languages?
Of the acts playing the festival? Right,
but common is it normally when the acts appear? Are they in their desire to be international and to kind of, you know, travel beyond their home countries? Do most of these acts actually sing in English?
A lot of them do. I think, like, a lot of them that comes over to England, they choose to sing in English. And I think for Nordic countries as well, the most of the population in the different countries speak really, really well English. So I think it's,
Good. Well, we're going to move on. This is it Niels Bech or Bech?
Bech.
Bech. Great, even yeah. Bech. Yeah. Well, it's spelled B-E-C-H. Yeah. And this is I Punish You.
I punish you as I cast myself in turning to another, the play between.
Well, that could almost be the 1980s. That could be like Depeche Mode or OMD or something.
Yeah.
It's, that
or
takes almost you back.
Almost a bit kind of Arthur Russell. Yes. And has a bit of, yeah.
So where's Niels from?
Niels is from Oslo as well. He comes from...
We must point out that you are Norwegian as well.
I hope
so there's someone on here who's not Norwegian, but we'll come to that later on.
So Niels comes from... he trained as a kind of classical musician and he also trained for the opera. And then he just decided to do more kind of poppy and electro stuff.
So again, interestingly, you know, one from the conservatorium, one from opera.
Yeah.
Is it quite a common route that people actually do learn, you know, the craft of music and then actually go off on a pop route?
Yeah, I think all the Nordic countries have a very good music educational programs in the different universities. And we do find that a lot of, the artists coming out of the Nordic region, they do...
They're a bit more talented than your average strummer or who can do two chords. We've got quite a bit of time left, but let's move on to make sure we get both of the last tracks in. When Saints Go Machine is a band that we've played a lot here on Monocle 24. They're a bit of a favourite around these parts. This is Love and Respect, or System of Unlimited Love. Well, that was the Love extending to Copenhagen. That's a Danish act. And just tell us a little bit about them.
Four piece from Copenhagen. This track is from the album Infinity Pool, which came out last year, and it's with the Atlanta rapper. Killer Mike is featured on that. A fantastic band, also doing different other projects. A project called Cancer, which we had on our club night like a few months ago. And they're also in another project called Keaton/Demon, I believe they're called, yeah.
And tell me, so it's interesting, so all of these bands are going to be in London for the same two or three nights. Do you put them all up in the same hotel?
No, a lot of them crash with friends, and yeah, it's
there's not kind of a dangerous drinking zone around one hotel.
Probably will be, but yeah, but both When Saints Go Machine and High Society playing our Saturday show at the Great Hall in Mile End.
So most of the evenings have a variety of bands on in during the one kind of gig.
Yeah, we have in total 15 acts over 3 days. So Thursday and Friday at the Lexington in Angel, and then Saturday at the Great Hall in Mile End.
Well, the final track is from Low Roar, and it's called I'm Leaving. So Nina, this is a gentleman who made the rather rash decision to move from California to Iceland.
Yeah, he did indeed, which is quite interesting. Yeah,
he gave up on the beach for the kind of the volcanoes.
Yeah, yeah.
And just tell us about him.
No, yeah, singer-songwriter, the project of a guy called Ryan Karischa. I'm not really...
Good, finally you have a name to stumble over. It's not just me falling over all these Nordic names.
Yeah, yeah, really amazing live, yeah, just beautiful. Reminds me a bit of Bon Iver in some parts,
Just tell me, do you think when you listen to all this music, there is a bit of the landscape of the North in all of these tracks?
I do think there is, yeah. I think you can tell that there's kind of like a Nordic sound to it, I think, yeah.
Yeah, there's a kind of a magic, a kind of beauty, which is not what you'd hear, even if you just come a few hundred miles south to mainland Europe. There's something special in the music.
Yeah, and I do think with Laura Roar, you can, even if he's from California, I think you could see that he's influenced by
He's managed to kind of get that Iceland vibe.
Yeah.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for coming in to see us. That's Nina Finnerud, and she's the project manager for the Ya 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 Festival here in London. And that festival is going to run from the 13th to the 15th of November.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all we have on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, who are John Everard, who is, of course, a former British ambassador to North Korea, and George Brock, who is a professor of journalism. Today's show, well, it was produced by Emily Elias. It was researched by David Pleasant, and our studio manager was the one and only Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, it's Monocle's design program, which is, of course, called Section D. Then, at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily, and that's tonight presented by Emma Nelson and her usual sidekick, Mr. Andrew Mueller. This show, well, of course, it'll be back tomorrow, and, of course, at the same time, which is 1800 hours, London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.